This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
The dirt behind denial.
Social barriers against climate action. Neuropsychologist Adam Aron investigates with his book, The Climate Crisis.
From Grist, senior writer Naveen Asada Sivam breaks stories of state repression, corporate wrongdoing, and outright corruption to grease the deadly status quo.
Nobody thinks climate misinformation is accidental.
Near the middle of April, Fort Lauderdale, Florida got about one-third of their annual rainfall in just 8 hours. 2 feet of rain fell at the airport. Statistically, that is a one-in-a-thousand-year event, but that is based on the old weather. We'll see it much sooner than that. A hotter, wetter atmosphere has lots of surprises for us. Over in Europe, the EU's Copernicus system reports the hottest March ever recorded. Last week, a humongous, record-smashing heat wave hit Pakistan, most of northern India, right down into Thailand and even Malaysia. Most places were above 43 degrees C, 109 Fahrenheit. It is brutal heat in April. The U.S. Northeast hit 90 degrees Fahrenheit, 32 C, in New York City, briefly. Nobody alive can remember April heat like that. A couple of days later, another cold wave took all that away. It's totally unstable. Lurking behind the heat are the oceans, hotter than they have been for millions of years. Marine heat waves hovered in the North Pacific and Atlantic. This is a hot time on the old planet, with an El Niño likely approaching by fall. It may get a whole lot hotter. Obviously, the climate emergency has arrived. That makes the new surge to pump out even more fossil fuels so sick, so sad. Joe Biden's America is doing it, opening up the new Arctic resources. And that's not just the Willow Project, but another, an 870-mile-long unnatural gas pipeline. They want to get more methane out to the sea as frozen LNG. It is patriotic boom time for the oil, gas, and coal men. They do it even when everybody knows. Fossil mania kills children, kills their future. Tell them no. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Imagine an expert studying psychology in the brain wakes up to discover climate disaster threatens everything. Does she or he drop everything to look for climate solutions? At the University of California, San Diego, Professor Adam Aron sort of did. As a recognized expert in cognitive neuropsychology, he began teaching undergrad courses called Psychology of the Climate Crisis. Then he put it all in an accessible textbook, The Climate Crisis, published by Cambridge University Press in 2023. What can we learn about how minds, hearts, and lives change? From San Diego, California, Adam Aron, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thanks very much, Alex. Glad to be here.
Just to warm up, what is a neuropsychologist? What did you study?
So there's different kinds of psychologists, but the neuropsychologist is the kind of psychologist who tries to understand how the mind works by also bringing the brain into the equation. So I did experiments, sat people down in front of computers, measured how they move, how they decide how to move, how they stop moving, and while doing so, measured their brain in various sorts of ways.
A few years ago, world-recognized sustainability expert Jem Bendel dropped out of his field. He said none of it was sustainable. Recently, you talked with Allison Green, another successful academic who left to become an activist. She's now director of the group Scientists Warning. Adam, why did you make the big change in your career?
I understood about we didn't call it the climate crisis back then, but I knew that there was global heating probably for about 20 years. I remember being a PhD student and getting the memo and being concerned about it. But I was so busy doing my career and being a parent and distracted by other things. And it's really around about 2016 that I sort of had the space to get involved, and I got involved in the fossil fuel divestment movement at the UC system. But I don't think I really was even an activist at that point. I didn't really understand how serious this was until I got my eyes on the IPCC 2018 report, the so-called 1.5 Celsius report. Now, that was a turning point, I think, for many people. I took a little bit of time to look at that because I was preparing a class, and it's really when I got my own eyes on this, the scientific data, and really understood the seriousness of the predicament that I just became really alarmed, and I felt like I'm in a position of privilege here. I'm a tenured professor. I have the bandwidth. I have the time. I have, you know, the capacity to dedicate more of my time to the climate crisis. And it sort of went bit by bit as I started teaching, and then I was an activist and organizing in the University of California. And I just started spending more and more of my time on this to the point where I just felt I have to just stop doing neuroscience altogether and dedicate myself to it. So that's how it happened.
Many of us hope this generation of students can respond to climate challenges where their parents failed. You taught a course, Psychology of the Climate Crisis. What did you learn from your students?
Well, you know, my general view on this is we shouldn't be saying to students, you've got to deal with this, you've got to solve it. I think we older people need to do so too, and particularly we've benefited from it with our high carbon intensive lifestyle, so we need to be part of the equation too. But yeah, learning from the students, I mean, it's hard to generalize, but a lot of young people, for example, I think about undergrads in the University of California, even if they haven't taken my class or haven't even really taken any class about climate change that gets into depth, they understand and they intuit from the wider education they've had or from the media that we really have a problem here, and they feel, in general, if I can generalize, they feel deadened and helpless and hopeless, and it's something that they don't really want to think about very much because they don't know what to do. And so what I think learned by teaching the students, interacting with them, is that there's a way to present the climate predicament and the seriousness of it and the pace at which it's unfolding and the inadequacy of national and international action, and couple that very heavy message, sort of reality-based message, at the same time with, you know, a grounded kind of optimism, right, a sense of the power of social movements, how social change is made. And I think the magic bullet, I haven't really worked this out myself, but is to combine the dread and the fear and the anxiety about this terribly, serious unfolding predicament with hopeful messages that are grounded in how social change is made. And I think when I do a good job at that, at times I find the eyes light up, you know, and students jump in and get involved in all sorts of ways. So I think that's what I've learned. There's a combination that's important here in our communication and our teaching.
The book Climate Crisis tries to resolve questions frustrating to so many of us. Just as science enters a golden era of understanding how life in this planet works right out into the galaxies, humanity seems unable to get off a suicidal pathway. Did you manage to bring over tools from cognitive psychology to help us in the climate struggle?
Well, I didn't bring tools from neuroscience, that's for sure, although I did bring, I guess, my scientific training, which is helpful. But I am in a psychology department, and I am sort of closer to the field of social psychology and environmental psychology just by virtue of, you know, the kinds of techniques and understanding I have. And so I suppose to some extent I've been able to delve into the wider literature, particularly of the social psychology of collective action and some of the psychology research that's been done on beliefs and attitudes. And definitely I've been able to incorporate some of that in how I teach and how I understand the issue and how to get bigger societal level mobilization, yes.
So many books and so much research tends to leave out Africa and climate impacts. In your book, you interview a climate activist from Mozambique. Why your personal interest, and what happens in Africa if we allow the world to warm 3 degrees C?
Yes, I originally grew up in southern Africa in a small country called Swaziland. And, you know, it's sort of foremost in my mind. I mean, I was privileged there, you know, a little white boy growing up in black Africa and going to an international school. But I was very mindful at the time, and I'm certainly very mindful now, that of those landscapes, of the large mammals, of those trees, of the local people who've done very little to incur any of this. They live with very little carbon intensity. They're not flying around in jet airplanes. And I can just intuit and actually start to see the impacts unfolding on them that they were not going to be able to adapt to and be resilient towards. And so that imbues me with a greater sense of responsibility. I'm in the climate struggle on behalf of a wider humanity that doesn't have the privilege I do. So that's part of my focus. And I think it's important to bring those African voices and voices from elsewhere in the global south into my teaching and book. And there's really not enough of that in my teaching and book, but I'd like to get more. Your question about the impacts on Africa, well, global heating is going to be felt unevenly. I mean, partly it's that the amount of heating is unequal. Parts of sub-Saharan Africa are slated to experience about double the heating of the global average, so that's one issue. And the other important issue is they are much more vulnerable in their agriculture, and their way of living to climate change and the impacts. I mean, for example, they've experienced colossal cyclones, they call them, rather than hurricanes, hitting Mozambique and Malawi, devastating entire cities. And, you know, in the United States, we just keep rebuilding, but they can't rebuild. So I'm alert to one of the senses or meanings of climate justice. It has many different meanings, but one of them is that the, you know, the impacts of climate crisis are felt much more on some people than others, and it's particularly the vulnerable people who will get the greatest impacts and have done the least to incur the problem.
Over the years, I've seen maps projecting deserts developing in a wide band around the equator as the world heats. In this book, we find something new, at least it was to me. You provide a map showing the increase in regions becoming really too hot for humans. Places over 29 degrees C, mean average temperatures, go from a few spots in North Africa and the Middle East to some of the most heavily populated places on the planet, including in Pakistan and India, as early as 2070 on our current path. What would that mean? What would happen?
Well, that's the work of Tim Lenton and others, published in Prestigious National Academy of Sciences and a number of other journals. That is assuming what's called the RCP 8.5, in other words, the sort of worst pathway that the IPCC considers, where we keep on extracting and burning fossil fuels, which we seem to be right now. But, of course, we may get off that pathway. Things may not turn out as bad, depending on what we do. But if we stay on a very bad pathway and we incur tipping points and we escalate our emissions, then that doesn't seem unlikely that what is now just a few hot spots around the Sahara and Djibouti would basically expand to affect, you know, the mean annual temperature would be like that in about, you know, affecting about up to 3 billion people. So presumably what will happen is there'll be massive migration out of those areas, and it'll put orders of magnitude more pressure on Europe than we saw even from the Syrian war, and pressure on the U.S. southern border. And so this is part, I think, of why the U.S. military and the Pentagon have called climate change the greatest threat they face. That seems to have fallen out of the news lately, but I think they worried about global instability.
Well, this is one of the wild things for me in American politics. I mean, shouldn't conservatives be among the first to fight for emissions reduction so the tide of foreigners they fear so much does not become a reality?
That is a good idea. And that's part of what we call, in our science communication, co-benefits framing, right? If we consider conservative Americans or Republicans, to some extent they will support policy irrespective of beliefs about climate change. They don't have to change their minds about climate change to support good policy. And you see examples of that on jobs. You see examples of that on air pollution. And as you rightly pointed out, I think another example is national security. I don't know how common that is, but that's a very good avenue of potential communication to get people to support policy just on those grounds alone.
Well, let's chat about what you cover in Chapter 4, Capitalism and the Climate. Do you think climate change and general destruction of nature are inherent to capitalism and its compulsion to always expand?
Yeah, I think it's connected. I think the expansionary compulsion is inherent to any form of capitalism, even the, you know, the nicer forms, if you want to put it like that. And that's partly why we need to consider, you know, what I refer to in that chapter as post-growth policy, sometimes called degrowth, which I think is a confusing term, but post-growth policies. We certainly can keep a capitalist system, but take some of the sting out of it by bringing in policies that, you know, reduce consumption. So that's part of it.
And surveys show belief or disbelief in climate appears in clusters, partly according to economic beliefs like socialism or free market capitalism. Do we know why voting habits and belief in climate tend to line up? Does it tell us anything useful?
I think it does. It's tricky because in the United States, we just really have two parties, and so there's not a lot of space for nuance. And in countries where you have many more parties, people can kind of align themselves a bit differently. So someone could be conservative on economics, maybe, or conservative on social issues, but still be, you know, fervently a believer in climate change. And here, it's all sort of wrapped up together. To put it simplistically, perhaps, I mean, the belief in the preeminence of the free market and not wanting government interference and believing in hierarchical organization and believing in individualism, all of those things sort of go together with each other. And those are beliefs that are strongly correlated with not believing in climate change or not believing in the human cause. And I think, you know, there's a number of issues wrapped up there, but one of them is that climate change or the climate crisis is a rude awakening for people who, you know, can't countenance government intervention. And we're going to have serious policies. So if you're against government introducing policies, you're automatically going to have a strong bias not to believe in climate change.
I read on in your book to see if you, as a professor at a high-ranked American university, call for revolution for an end to capitalism. You do not. Why not?
Well, I'm not a revolutionary myself. I'm not a Marxist revolutionary in that sense. The way I'd answer that is just to say I would actually quote one of my intellectual heroes, no other than Noam Chomsky, who, or paraphrase him, you know, his whole life has been, you know, an ardent critic of capitalism, right? And so he wrote this interesting book, I think, Global Climate Crisis and the Green New Deal, I think it's called, with the UMass economist Robert Polin. And, you know, while starting out saying, you know, we need to do what we can to make a better world, they made the very, I think, realistic and cogent point that in the time scale we have for climate stabilization, right, which, by the way, is probably the next 10 years, there really isn't time to countenance any kind of overthrow of capitalism. We need to be able to make the changes we can under state capitalist systems. And they go further and point out that those state capitalist systems are compatible with industrial policy and all kinds of levels of market interference and state subsidy and initiative, and have been so for years. I mean, if you think back to the New Deal era, that's what it was. There was a capitalist system with substantive interference. World War II in the United States, a capitalist system. An emergency was declared. The public supported it, and they were rationing. You know, you weren't allowed to drive cars for joyriding. All air conditions were requisitioned for the war effort. There was standardization of production. 22 million victory gardens were grown, and infant mortality went down, and health outcomes went up, and people tolerated it. And if we think about the pandemic, I mean, the year 2020, over about an 18-month period, I think the federal government pumped about $4 trillion into the U.S. economy. You know, people experiencing homelessness were housed in hotels up and down the land, and most of us were paid to stay at home. So we certainly can, under a capitalist system, see very significant state intervention, subsidies, and industrial policy. And I think to get climate stabilization, that's at least a necessary ingredient of what we have to do.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
You are listening to neuropsychologist and climate activist Adam Aron on Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. We are talking about the mind in climate crisis and what we can do. Adam, under U.S. law, a corporation is a person with all the rights of a person. If ExxonMobil or Saudi Aramco are people, what would a psychologist say about them? What kind of people are they?
Well, they're psychopaths or sociopaths, I suppose. I mean, it's not so simple. Those companies and their executives have a fiduciary responsibility to maximize profits, right? And the rest of us are busy consuming a lot of the time. If we can't escape it, we don't have enough money to escape it right now. We're consuming their product. So they sort of integrate in our system. But, I mean, I think it's very important to recognize that their culpability and responsibility goes beyond just their role as maximizers of shareholders' profits, which is that from the 1970s and 80s, ExxonMobil and Shell very clearly understood that burning fossil fuels was going to produce global heating and devastating damage. We've got ample documents to prove that now. Actually, there were revelations yesterday about Shell Oil actually mapping out different scenarios. And even though they had that information back then, as did the U.S. government and U.S. government scientists in the 1970s and late 70s and early 80s, they deliberately chose a pathway of confusion, distortion, denial, fermenting, dissent, and they've carried on doing that to this day. It's taken on different guises. And it's because of that pattern of deliberately trying to confuse the public, greenwashing, and promoting misinformation that I think they are absolutely culpable. That's what makes them sociopaths and psychopaths, and, you know, they need to be held accountable.
I totally agree. Climate misinformation is not accidental. Massive global fossil interests injected billions into plans and machinations designed to neuter public demand for real action, and some of their hired guns used psychology against the public interest, I think. So how would you introduce students who are not really aware of it yet to this denial machine, as you call it?
Well, I talk about that in my Chapter 5. I have some parts about that. I mean, I suppose I would do it, you know, in two stages. I mean, first is to help students understand, you know, what was known. Maybe three stages. First, to understand what was known in the 1980s and sort of the history of Exxon New, as it were. Then to sort of carry that period from the mid-1980s to about 2010 or so, or maybe 2015 even, where there's this pattern of, you know, finding a few scientists who are going to speak out and make out that they're part of, you know, a consensus, to undermine the scientific consensus, to cause doubt on the IPCC, to obfuscate and distort the science. And then that's what they did for that period. And then from about, I think it's about 2015 until now, now the strategy has shifted, right? So the fossil fuel companies don't anymore deny that climate change is real. They don't even deny that burning fossil fuels is causing it. If you look at the ads of ExxonMobil, now what they do is position themselves as part of the climate solution, right? So I'd have to educate students about the history and the pattern of that form of denial and distortion, but then the new form that the propaganda has taken, and this is very much about touting climate solutions such as so-called carbon capture from smokestacks and blended hydrogen and offsets and all sorts of stunts like that.
And then there's the funding for universities. You pass on a shocking list of name-brand energy institutes from MIT to Stanford and Berkeley that get money from Chevron and BP and Shell and other companies. And I wonder, too, about all the universities that haven't divested from fossil fuels. You've got billions and billions of dollars that's actually funding something that will damage the future of the students they teach. How does all this money shape knowledge, or does it?
I think it does shape knowledge. I mean, Noam Oreskes and Ben Franta and Jeffrey Supran and people like this have written very convincing articles and books, book-length studies of the ways in which corporate money universities, but fossil money in particular, distorts the agenda. There was an article by Amy Westerfeld in The Guardian a couple of weeks ago sort of adding up the something like $700 million of fossil fuel money to U.S. universities over the last decade or something like that. And certainly in the University of California where I am, it's something like $130 million over the last 5 years to fund scientists and academics, not only from the fossil fuel industry, but also from the investor-owned utilities. So there are concrete examples one can give of what seem to be conflicts of interest and all sorts of influence peddling and buying. And there's a memo from, I think it's ExxonMobil, or actually no, from the fossil fuel industry, I think 1998, that Ben Franta has uncovered, that details what they call their strategy of actually influencing academics. So I can't give you those quotes right now specifically, but there's multiple examples of where this has been shown.
You clearly explain in the book the intentional misinformation machine, but that's not enough to explain some of the resistance to climate science out there. Some individuals, without any links to big oil or gas money, they make it their lives' work to chop down climate scientists, to put down any hopes. Why do they do it?
I think it's ideological. That of course, in some ways, describes most of mainstream economics, what you've just said. Neoclassical economics, I mean, not every economist, but in general, the field has hardly paid any attention to climate change. Something like 57 articles out of 77,000 as of 2019 in the mainstream journals covered climate change. And when they did, they tend to sort of dramatically underestimate the damages. So there's doctrinal, ideological resistance. I think if you are sort of an archetypal Cold War warrior, like some of the people in, you know, Naomi Klein's Merchants of Doubt book, then, you know, people intuit that dealing seriously with climate change requires, you know, government intervention, and you're fundamentally against government intervention, then you have a way in there to start fighting it. I think it's on those grounds. I think Naomi Klein said, you know, climate change detonates the central beliefs of conservatism, right? The neoliberal form wants to shatter solidarity and make everything individual and privatized. Well, this problem was going to require absolutely large amounts of solidarity and all forms of regulation and government subsidy and government interference and good policies. And so it's a direct challenge to the fundamental ideology of neoliberal capitalism. I guess that's a simple way of putting it.
Can you give our listeners any tips on what to do and what not to do when confronted with someone strongly arguing against climate reality?
Well, I'm not so good on that on the fly myself. I tend to get hot under the collar. But I think there's a number of strategies I talk about in the book if I'm more cool-headed about it. There's different kinds of skepticism. The first I talk about is epistemic skepticism. In other words, people skeptical about the knowledge that there's a human cause, that the impacts are here. And there's response skepticism, right? People accept that climate change is a real thing, but they seem to want to deny that they have any role to play. So first of all, you have to sort of ask, you know, what kind of skeptic am I dealing with? And if you're dealing with the first kind, which is the epistemic skeptic, then there's a couple of techniques that can be used. One of them is called in-group messaging, right? So if you're dealing with evangelicals, then it's helpful to find an evangelical. I can say, you know, I'm like Catherine Hayhoe, professor. I'm an evangelical, and I believe in climate change. And that's an incredibly powerful thing to do. People in the South, someone speaks to them with a Southern accent. So the sort of in-group messaging. The other thing is to recognize that when you talk with someone like, you know, your skeptical uncle in the California Central Valley or something like that, the things that people say about climate change being a hoax or the things they say about vaccines are what you could call the surface attitudes. And you seldom get anywhere by sort of confronting people on the surface attitudes with data and facts. But those surface attitudes reflect underlying attitude roots. And the attitude roots are their worldviews and ideologies, the conspiracy thinking and the vested interests. Now, it's difficult to do this on the fly in conversation. I'm not very good at it. But if you start talking to someone who expresses epistemic skepticism about climate change, and you can actually start instead having a conversation with them about their underlying attitude roots, for example, their fears about government intervention, and you could talk about World War II or the COVID pandemic or examples of the New Deal, you might actually be able to shift people's beliefs on the underlying attitude root, and that may shift their surface attitude. So that's one kind of suggestion. And also, as I mentioned earlier, you know, the co-benefits framing, people who are skeptical about climate change can actually support policy even without changing their beliefs about climate change. So, for example, ranchers in Colorado wanted to take advantage of wind by installing turbines on their lands, and so they put pressure on the Republican governor of Colorado to bring a clean electricity standard, right? And so you can get good policy that actually gives you clean electricity without people actually changing their climate change beliefs.
You would think people whipped by repeated strong hurricanes or burned out by heat wave wildfires would be converted to climate science, but it seems many continue to vote for fossil fuel candidates and their pools of disinformation. Why doesn't direct experience of catastrophe modify beliefs?
It's a great question. You know, when I first started getting into this in about 2019, 2018, and preparing my class, Psychology of the Climate Crisis, I had this strong intuition that extreme weather was going to be a great teacher of Americans' climate opinions. And now we're in 2023, and it doesn't seem, it's a mixed picture, you know, and the literature is mixed. There's a number of reasons for that. I mean, one of them is this thing called shifting baselines. You know, psychologically, and there's actually evidence to support this in the climate case, if you experience, you know, a dramatic extreme over and over and over again, then it becomes your new normal, right? You could sort of think of it, it's called shifting baselines. You can think of it as like a group of people are fishing the ocean, and there's way fewer fish than their grandparents, but they keep fishing, and they don't know that. And then their children are fishing, you know, and there's even fewer fish, but they don't realize that. So we sort of adjust. But it is a complicated story, and it's a little hard to summarize right now. My general sense is that extreme weather can be a good teacher of climate opinions, but we need to kind of understand it better.
In your book, you assess all kinds of energy alternatives, even nuclear and geoengineering. I felt you left out a different possible driver for social change, and that would be collapse or a series of smaller regional collapses. Maybe things have to fall apart for the new to be born. Your thoughts?
That could be. I'm not sure what that would look like. You know, the worry is that we are sort of headed to collapse if we carry on like this in a few decades, perhaps, right? But we have a limited time frame now of something like 10 years to achieve climate stabilization, which is to say, or some level of climate stabilization, which is to say if we can dramatically cut emissions in about the next 10 years, then we don't have to incur the worst outcomes. There's probably some amount of heating baked in no matter what we do. No one knows how much. But we don't have to have 2.2 or 2.7 or 3.2 Celsius. We need people to wake up now and be part of a social tipping point before we get the physical tipping point. And the worry of what you're talking about is real collapses like, for example, very substantial failure of crops, mass migration from parts of the world, things like that. By the time that stuff starts happening, it might be a bit late, right? We sort of reached a kind of physical tipping point, and then it doesn't matter so much whether we try and leave fossil fuels in the ground. So I would answer your question by saying we've got to find a way to motivate people to be part of a social mobilization before we have some seriously large-scale catastrophes.
Do you see a hope of mass social action, and how would that take place?
Yeah, I think that's the critical question. For me as a social scientist, probably the most important question, I wish more people felt like this, is really how are we going to find a way to get a bigger social mobilization in about the next 10 years, if not sooner, on climate crisis? There's many reasons why people don't band together to do things, but I think a central issue is they need to have a local theory of change. And I'm quite confident about the local theory of change myself, which says that particularly in a place like California, if one can galvanize one's local city, one's local institutions, you help trigger policy changes throughout the state that get us off the fossil fuels and get us onto a renewable transition.